Today's cases will be called as previously announced, and the times will be as allotted to counsel. The first case today is before I do that, Judge Selya, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Thank you, Judge. The first case today is number 24-1264, United States versus Miguel Paveo. At this time, would counsel for the appellant please introduce himself on the record to begin?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Zachary Cunha for the United States. Judge Rickleman, if I could reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
You may.
Your Honors, the District Court committed two errors below, and as a result wrongly concluded that the gun on Mr. Paveo's person should be suppressed. First, the District Court incorrectly determined, in direct contravention of this Court's precedent, that the officer on the scene lacked reasonable suspicion to extend a concededly lawful car stop of the defendant's vehicle. And second, the District Court erred in finding that defendant's conduct, and specifically this was a repeated, concerning, and extensive pattern of reaches for and glances at his waistband, combined with some other conduct, provided a reasonable suspicion basis for a Terry pat-down frisk. I'd like to address each of those briefly. There is no question, and I think as a backdrop to this, the District Court found that the officer Bemis's testimony was truthful and straightforward. All of that evidence is before the Court as it conducts de novo review of the suppression decision. And all of that establishes that at the time Officer Bemis made a decision to extend the stop and called for backup, he had smelled raw marijuana, and he had observed a small quantity of raw marijuana on the passenger side floor. Under this Court's precedents in Stalla and Bazier, that provides probable cause and ergo provides reasonable suspicion to extend the stop. The assessment is a Fourth Amendment assessment. It does not turn on the status of marijuana under state law. It turns on whether there is evidence confronting the officer of any criminal offense. This Court has made that clear repeatedly, in some ways prefiguring the Supreme Court's decision in Virginia versus Moore, that that is sufficient for Fourth Amendment purposes. The government emphatically did not waive this issue. It presented it below repeatedly, unequivocally, and emphatically, and the District Court was bound by this Court's precedents in Stalla and Bazier.
You read those as holdings in both cases, the part that bears on this case, as opposed to alternative grounds or dicta?
Well, I think certainly in Stalla we read it that way, and to the extent Your Honor is concerned about the reference in a footnote to Maine's decriminalization of marijuana in Bazier, I do think that that constitutes an alternative holding of the Court and was binding on the District Court. But regardless of whether the Court views it that way or otherwise, what Bazier also unequivocally says as part of its holding is that any offense is sufficient for Fourth Amendment purposes. And there is no question for Fourth Amendment purposes that marijuana remains federally prescribed. It remains a controlled substance under federal law, and therefore furnishes an offense that would support either probable cause or reasonable suspicion.
Was that argument made by the government at the original suppression hearing?
It was, Your Honor. The notion that the federal illegality of marijuana remained controlling was argued by my count on at least 8 instances. I would point the Court to Joint Appendix 54, 62, 70, and 71. Those are all from the government's written opposition to the motion to suppress. 2 are in footnotes, 2 are in the body of the text. I'd also point to Joint Appendix 159 and 166. That's from the oral argument on the motion, the government's position. The government again raised the issue in its written submission on reconsideration. That's Joint Appendix 184. And again, at oral argument on reconsideration. That's Joint Appendix 200.
So, counsel, I understand your point about the interpretation of the previous cases, but I am just curious what your position is at this point. In a state in which marijuana has been legalized, which are several states in the First Circuit, of course, the government's position is that if an officer pulls over a car for a traffic violation, an admitted traffic violation, and there's any amount of marijuana, even trace amount of marijuana in the car that the driver admits to, in every single circumstance, there's therefore sufficient reason to search the entire car because of the federal law? Is that the government's position?
Well, the government's position is that that is what this Court has indeed said, based on Stalla and Bazier. I think to the extent, and one of the points that I would make, as we emphasized in our briefing, is that was the situation in Maine. It's been the situation in Maine for nearly 50 years since the decriminalization in 1976, which almost perfectly mirrors Rhode Island's decriminalization in 2012.
But the facts in that case, and, you know, we've been discussing, is it a holding, is it an alternative holding, is it dicta? The facts are completely different. I mean, there's clear indications of driving under the influence, which remains a crime no matter what. So I guess I just want to go back, just putting aside for a moment, if we disagree on what was held previously, is that the government's position that in any state where marijuana is legalized, if you're pulled over for a traffic violation and there's a trace amount, it authorizes the officer to do a search of the entire car?
Well, if I could, Your Honor, I think I'd like to address that in three ways. First, those may not be the precise facts of Bazier, but they are almost precisely the same facts as Stala, which involved a very small quantity of marijuana. In fact, that case involved the smell of burned marijuana rather than raw marijuana. I think as a Fourth Amendment principle, the government believes, yes, as long as it remains a federal offense, this Court's decisions in Smith and in Ryan and the Supreme Court's decision in Virginia versus Moore teach that that is sufficient for Fourth Amendment probable cause purposes in a Fourth Amendment, in a federal prosecution. To the extent that the Court is concerned about some spillover effect for this, that the increased decriminalization of marijuana in states is going to lead to an upsurge in arrests or prosecutions, I would point out that, number one, that certainly hasn't happened based on the federal case law in the past 50 years, or the past decade since Rhode Island has decriminalized this. I would also point out that even in Rhode Island, when this issue finally reached the Rhode Island Supreme Court, the Rhode Island Supreme Court concluded that under their law, that this remained relevant in the reasonable suspicion calculus.
Well, they said it remained relevant under the totality of the circumstances.
Correct.
That would be considered, but your argument seems to be that alone is enough. That seems like two quite different things to me. You know, a factor in the overall totality of whether a search is allowed versus automatic search, even if there's only a trace about.
I think there is a difference, Your Honor. I don't know that I would draw the distinction quite that markedly, since the Rhode Island Supreme Court was at pains to emphasize that marijuana remains contraband. I think the prescription under federal law provides a legal violation, a crime, that gives the officer reasonable suspicion to extend the stop.
Your position, if I understand it logically, isn't just that there was reasonable suspicion to extend the stop. But if I'm understanding your argument is the officer could have arrested him. There was probable cause.
That's correct, Your Honor. I mean,
and if that's your position, then are you arguing, did you argue below, or are you arguing to us that because there was probable cause to make an arrest, then the pat-down doesn't need to be justified under Terry. It could be just as incident to a lawful arrest.
I want to be very clear, Your Honor. We did not raise search incident or inevitable discovery below. I have focused on the probable cause issue because perhaps I'm misconceiving this, but I view reasonable suspicion as a lesser standard than probable cause. Ergo, if you've met the higher standard, you've met the lower one. That's why we framed our argument that way.
Well, but the difference then comes to whether there is search incident to arrest.
Well, yes, and I think on that issue, again, I want to be very clear for the record, we did not raise that issue below, and therefore I'm not pressing that issue here. Our position is that...
But wouldn't that be the logical conclusion of your position?
Well, Your Honor, had we raised search incident or inevitable discovery below, I certainly think we would prevail on that basis. Being here, having not raised those issues, I think we have a waiver issue with respect to those arguments, in candor to the Court. And that's why our argument to Judge Kayada with respect to the Terry pat-down is not focused on whether there was probable cause to make an arrest. It's focused on this really significant and concerning pattern of behavior on the part of the defendant at the time he is waiting for backup to, at the time the officer is waiting for backup to arrive, and once he's taken out of the vehicle. And I think it's particularly significant given this Court's decision. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No.
Oh,
please.
Given this
I'm listening.
Court's decision in DuBose, which instructs the district court to take into account the officer's experience and training, that this is an officer whose ordinary practice, he testified, would have been to go back to his vehicle and run checks on the driver, and he didn't do that because Mr. Pavo reached for his waistband almost immediately. He did that repeatedly and consistently to the point that he had to be told to stop. He continued when he was ordered out of the car. He was told to put his hands on his head specifically because of that waistband-related conduct, which also included what the officer called target glancing, which in his experience suggested that there was something at that waistband location. And then yet again, we're now talking 5 to 7 minutes after the initial interaction at the rear of the vehicle before he is patted down. He once again goes for his waistband, and his hands have to be physically taken and put on the back of the truck. And all of that is a significant, cohesive course of conduct that provides reasonable suspicion for a Terry pat in the government's view.
You refer to the officer's conduct. I'm a little puzzled. How do we approach that, given that where our inquiry here is not focused on the subjective beliefs of the officer? On the other hand, I suppose the officer's behavior could offer some degree of corroboration to what the officer is, in fact, observing. I'm not sure how we deal with that.
Well, Your Honor, the best way I have thought to deal with that, to reconcile what this court has said in DuBose with what this court has said in other cases, and that it is unequivocally an objective standard, is that one looks at whether a reasonable officer with the training, experience, or background that is at issue here would have made the conclusions that this officer did. I don't know that I have a better answer than that, but I think that's the best way of reconciling the tension.
Counsel, one of the other things that I'm struggling with is I read Officer Bemis's testimony, and it's an objective standard, as you say, but he also seems to make clear that he was actually never afraid, and the standard is there a reasonable basis to believe the person's armed and dangerous? And according to the testimony, Mr. Pavo complied with every single order from the officer. You know, he cooperated in every way. He put his hands on his head. He did whatever the officer asked, and Officer Bemis, and I think this is what the district court concluded, was really never afraid. So how are we supposed to factor that in, since he does need to think that the person is armed and dangerous?
I think two responses, Your Honor. First of all, he emphatically does not need to be afraid. So to the extent the district court is focusing on that, it's the wrong standard. It is, as Your Honor said, when there's a reasonable basis to believe he's armed and dangerous. And at this point, may I briefly conclude? At this point, he has an individual who has committed a drug offense, which this court in Harrington and other cases has said the connection between drugs and guns is legendary. He has the waistband-related conduct. He has the fact that while they're waiting, he pulls a baggie of marijuana out of his jacket, tosses it to the officer, and says, "Now you don't need to search my car." I think the point is that all of these circumstances combined, and Officer Bemis was very clear that he did have concerns about officer safety. He doesn't have to be afraid, but he did have concerns about officer safety, and a reasonable, objective officer in those circumstances would conclude that there was a fair probability that the defendant was armed and dangerous.
Judge Selye, do you have any questions?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. At this time, would counsel for the appellee please introduce himself on the record to begin?
May it please the court, my name is John Calcagni. I'm here today on behalf of the appellee, Miguel Pavo. It should come as no surprise that the appellee asks this court to deny the government's appeal and to affirm the decision of the district court suppressing the firearm discovered in this case by a City of Warren police officer who unreasonably extended a routine traffic stop in violation of the Fourth Amendment. The appellee concedes that this was a lawful traffic stop. However, two minutes into the stop, after the officer made the limited observations of the odor of marijuana, the presence of marijuana crumbs on the passenger side floorboard, and observing Mr. Pavo's hands to be slightly shaking, he immediately decided at that moment that he was going to conduct a search. That was his testimony at the hearing, further corroborated by him immediately calling for a secondary officer to assist, as at the time it was protocol or policy amongst officers in the City of Warwick to have an additional officer present when conducting a search. The inquiry for the court is whether or not at that moment, when the decision to search was made, whether or not there was reasonable suspicion to justify delaying or deviating from the traffic enforcement mission that justified the stop to begin with.
Why should we look to the time he called for backup rather than looking to the time immediately before the search was performed?
Your Honor, the reason for that...
I would think the officer would be able to take into account anything that happened before he actually performed the search.
Your Honor, what the court needs to do when looking at the facts is determine the point in time where the officer deviated from the initial mission that justified the stop in the first place. The teachings of Rodriguez suggest that the duration and scope of any search or stop is to be limited in scope by its initial intended purpose. This officer stopped the vehicle for the perceived infraction. Of course, at that point in time, he asked Mr. Pavo for his documentation, and rather than running the checks on that documentation and issuing the citation, he stopped in his own tracks, continued to maintain his presence at the side of Mr. Pavo's vehicle, and called for backup at this point in his own testimony, indicating that he made a decision to search. He further testified that in encountering any motorist in the field, that if he ever detected the odor of marijuana, assuming that the occupants of the vehicle didn't possess and present a medical marijuana card, it was always his practice to then search to determine if the motorist possessed a decriminalized amount, that is an ounce or less, or under state law, a criminal amount, an amount exceeding 1 ounce.
So let's assume we limit our inquiry to the point in time that you suggest our inquiry should begin. At that point, after he had stopped and after he had smelled the marijuana and then observed some raw marijuana in the car, didn't there exist reasonable suspicion, indeed probable cause, that there was a violation of federal law, criminal law?
That's a trick question, and I'll tell you why. On its face, marijuana remains a Schedule I controlled substance. There's no denying that. On its face, possession of marijuana is a violation of federal law. But we're dealing with a city police officer charged with enforcing the laws of the state
okay,
of Rhode Island.
Okay, so let's take that a step at a time. I think in response to what you characterize as a trick question, your answer is yes.
Yes, Your Honor.
So then my next question is given that the officer had observed in front of him in the car a violation of federal criminal law, what authority is there to say that he could not at that point detain for a search based on the reasonable suspicion that he observed a violation of federal criminal law? And I understand he's not, if he were a DEA agent, could he have done this search?
I think if he was a DEA agent ferreting out violations of federal law, he may have been able to do the search.
But what doubt do you have?
Well, Your Honor, we have to examine the fact that the facts and circumstances of this case must be analyzed in the context of the decriminalization. Otherwise, we run into a federalism problem, the silver platter doctrine issue that I raised in my brief, where you have a direct conflict between the existing state laws, and the states have the police power to regulate and set forth what their criminal laws are going to be, and we have a direct conflict in the way that the federal government is enforcing its laws with regard to marijuana. And no one said it best than Justice Thomas in the Akinbo statement that I referenced in my memo.
Sure. Do you have any authority that says that a state police officer, law enforcement official, cannot cite as probable cause for an arrest or a detention the violation of federal law?
I can't offer you a case, Your Honor. This is the first time that this court is being asked to address the issue.
How about any court?
Well, I think that a number of courts that have addressed the odor of marijuana in the wake of decriminalization as it relates to criminal procedure and probable cause and reasonable suspicion have highlighted the fact that the analysis has changed. Now, if we simply view it through the prism of the federal law, it takes us right back to the holding installer that the government relies on in this case. But to do that is to ignore the evolution of the law as we know it. Nearly 40 states have decriminalized marijuana. The federal government and our Congress has yet to remove marijuana from the Controlled Substances Act. That's a fact. But there has been guidance from the government as to how that law is to be enforced, permitting the states to operate in the manner upon which they are.
So I think if I'm following correctly, your argument requires that we reject the statements that the prosecution cites in both Stoller and Bisier.
I'm not asking the court to reject them. I'm asking the court to recontextualize them, considering the major changes that have affected the majority of states.
What's the difference between rejecting them and recontextualizing them?
If you were to reject those decisions, you would have to issue a ruling that the odor of marijuana is no longer a consideration. And I don't believe that that comports with many of the state court decisions that I've cited, including the state of Rhode Island, as my brother referenced, State v. Lee, a case that I had the ability to handle. But I will suggest this. Marijuana remains a factor. And if you look at simply the facts of this case, just the facts of this case, the odor of marijuana and the crumbs on the floor, those two facts do not rise to reasonable suspicion to believe that Mr. Pavo was in possession of a criminal amount of marijuana, as would be set forth under Rhode Island law, an amount to exceed 1 ounce. But the court must consider the wave of change that's been affecting this country. If it doesn't, it permits this conflict to remain. It also permits this silver platter doctrine problem that I referenced in my memo, thereby allowing state and local law enforcement officers to circumvent the state legislature and the changing marijuana laws that exist at the state level by turning cases over to the federal government. And that creates a fundamental problem of a conflict between the state and federal law. Yes, Your Honor.
The state and federal law is rarely synonymous in a variety of areas. Firearms cases, for example, for years have been turned over by state police and local police to federal authorities because the federal laws on firearm possession and use are stricter and more wide-ranging. No one has ever seen a criminal procedural or constitutional problem with that conduct. Why is this different?
I think that to distinguish the firearms laws, at least I'm not aware of any direct policies that have come from Congress or other political leaders in this country who have directed agencies such as the Department of Justice to relax their enforcement policies, as we have seen and read about as they pertain to marijuana laws, which have enabled the states to decriminalize, in some instances legalize or recreationalize the use, the possession, and the growing of marijuana. But for that federal government policy, which is well known, the states would not be able to act in the manner upon which they are. In the context of firearms offenses, I'm not aware of any liberalization or guidance from the federal government as it pertains to the enforcement of those laws.
You have an alternative argument, I believe, that the even if the officer was justified in detaining your client based on the discovery of the marijuana, that he wasn't justified in doing the pat-down search.
That's correct. And there was some discussion earlier about that. And Justice Rickleman brought up the fact that Officer Bemis, in his own testimony, did not fear for his own safety. And while that was his subjective feeling, my brother's correct. It is an objective standard.
Well, let me ask you about that, because I read Bemis as saying that he forewent acting in the way he normally would have, but for his concern about the reaching.
He did say that.
So he was concerned when he saw the reaching for the waistband, and concerned enough that he changed his procedure from what he would have done in a normal stop.
That's correct, Your Honor. So just focusing on his subjective state of mind as reflected in his testimony, he characterized him having a concern at not knowing what Mr. Pedro was reaching at or why, but did indicate that at no point was he in fear for his safety. Returning back to the applicable objective standard, the totality of the circumstances, would a reasonable officer have felt for his or her safety? And Judge McElroy articulated all of the reasons why she concluded that a reasonable officer would not have.
Well, what about an officer stopped someone on the side of the road, he sees them reaching towards the waistband multiple times, not just once. He instructs the person to stop doing it, and notwithstanding that instruction, the person does it again, and then the person glances down there as well. Why isn't that enough for an officer to worry that there's a gun in the waistband?
Well, I think that those are factors that should absolutely be taken into consideration, and whether those alone would cause a reasonable officer to fear is a fact-based determination. But there are more factors here that can't be ignored, such as Mr. Pavo's overall cooperation.
But he didn't cooperate on the crucial thing, which is stop reaching for your waistband.
Understanding that he continued to reach for his waistband, Judge McElroy concluded that that gesture was not done in a threatening manner, that there's no reason to suspect that Pavo had any weapons on his possession. There was no indication in his criminal background then known to the officer, which would give rise to any suspicions that he was had a violent criminal past or possession of weapons on that particular occasion.
But counsel, when we're looking at the specific facts and whether they amount to enough to justify a frisk, that's a legal question that we reviewed de novo, correct, based on the facts as found by the district court?
That's correct. The application.
The application. So I guess my question, similar to what Judge Kaye is asking you, is a reasonable officer sees someone repeatedly reaching for their waistband or target glancing, as the term is apparently. And as Judge Kayada mentioned, the officer instructs him, don't do that. Don't keep reaching for your waistband. And he continues to do that. Why is that not enough from an objective standpoint for a reasonable officer to say, I'm concerned about what may be there? And Officer Bemis said he didn't know what it was, but he said it could be either contraband or a weapon. Why is that not enough?
Because there are many other factors presented by this particular case. And the totality of the circumstances requirement implores upon the court to consider all of the intended factors. I recognize that the constant gesture posed some concern for the officer, but that's simply one factor to be taken into consideration, combined with the many others that are all itemized in Judge McElroy's decision. She considered the totality and concluded that an objective officer would not have feared for their safety, and we ask that you do the same.
But we review that de novo, so we don't give deference to her ultimate conclusion, correct?
That's correct. Subject to any further questions, I'm almost out of time.
Judge Selye, any further questions?
No, I'm content.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. At this time, would counsel for the appellant please reintroduce himself on the record? He has a 3-minute rebuttal.
Thank you. Zachary Cunha for the government. Three very brief points, Your Honor. First, to the extent that there's some concern that this is the federalization of marijuana prosecution, of course, it goes without saying that this is not a marijuana prosecution. It's a prosecution for a firearms offense. And to Judge Tejada's question regarding whether or not it's relevant that this is a federal violation observed by a state law enforcement officer, I think this court has repeatedly suggested that that is not relevant. If you look at this court's decision in Smith, that's the observation of a gun by a state law enforcement officer that violates federal law but not state law. That's held sufficient for Fourth Amendment purposes. If you look at Stalla and Bazier, the facts of those cases both involve arrests by state law enforcement officers. And if you look at this court's decision in Ryan, where an arrest for driving under the influence is made by an officer who's outside the scope of his jurisdiction to effect an arrest, that still doesn't matter for Fourth Amendment.
Counsel, how do you respond, though, to Mr. Pavo's attorney's argument that this really does create quite a conflict between state and federal law? Again, following the logic of your argument to its conclusion, it would suggest that not only could somebody's car now be searched, but actually they could be searched. There could be a frisk done in any state where marijuana is legal, where a small amount is found in a car. And so the person is now not only having a car search, but their own, you know, physical pat-down conducted while they've acted consistent with state law. They followed state law. Why doesn't that present a conflict that we need to look at carefully?
2 points. One, again, I think our point is that the court has looked at that, and that's been the law in this circuit for almost 50 years. And to the point that there are more states now that have decriminalized than were the case then, I think, you know, one response to that is if you look at my brother's argument that the federal government has in some ways restricted the enforcement of marijuana laws consistent with that liberalization, this court has decided in Bilodeau and most recently in Saroy 3 weeks ago, in an area where there is a direct congressional restriction on the Department of Justice's enforcement of marijuana laws where they impact state medical marijuana, which are not an issue here. And this court has ultimately concluded that if there is a freestanding crime, that that does not apply. And so I would suggest in this much more limited circumstance that there's a concern that state officers are going to make an arrest and attempt to convince a local United States attorney to take that case federally.
But counsel, Saroy, which is a case I'm familiar with,
yes.
The crime was that the actual state marijuana laws were being violated, that the person was not acting consistent with the laws that the state had passed. And that's, you know, again, there aren't facts to indicate that here, because what the officer originally saw, as Officer Bemis testified, he had no idea what the quantity was.
If I can briefly respond, Your Honor.
Yes.
I think, again, that's at the extremity when we're talking about a federal prosecution. Here, we're clearly not talking about prosecuting Mr. Pavo for a marijuana offense on the federal side of the ledger. And if we're talking about the question of reasonable suspicion to extend and inquire further, whether it's for safety, given Mr. Pavo's avowed swerving across lanes and the smell of marijuana or otherwise, there's reasonable suspicion to extend the stop. Per Judge Selya's question, you assess that at the moment that the decision is made. If there are no further questions, we'd rest on our brief and ask that the court reverse.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes argument in this case.